Welcome, everyone, on this Thursday to Redacted. So great to have all of you here. Devastation, of course, in Venezuela, but multiple earthquakes around the world, and a lot of concern over whether or not the tectonic tension is leading to California possibly being next. We have a geologist from California who's going to be joining us to look at the latest data. Of course, 2 weeks ago here on the show, we did a deep dive about the major report and concerns about California, but the devastation in Venezuela is just unbelievable. So we're going to talk about that.
We're going to talk about the Fed balance sheet because the Fed has enriched itself while life gets harder for everyday Americans. How has the Fed made money in the year 2026? Inflation out of control. The average American is hurting with the devalued dollar. The Trump administration now admitting that the 2026 wars were in order to strengthen global trade in U.S. dollar. What does that mean? It's all right for some, isn't it? We're going to talk to Peter Schiff about that for a second in a minute.
Yeah, indeed. And we're also going to talk about the Netherlands. The Netherlands, of course, yesterday admitted that they have euthanized a 12-year-old as part of their government's euthanasia program. This is only revealed thanks to documents that were revealed in front of Congress that happened over a year ago. So we didn't even learn about this from the health ministry, in the Netherlands. But yeah, this happened a year ago. But now other countries, including Canada, of course, are moving full steam ahead with euthanization of children as young as 0, 1 year old. Who's determining this? The government? We're going to talk about this horrible practice. So we're going to talk about that.
That's terrifying. We're also going to talk about how Ukraine has upped its attacks on Crimea. You see on social media now people fleeing Crimea. You know, the narrative is, that's it, they're taking Crimea back. That's an ignorant thing to say. We're going to look at what we really should see from this and whether or not the war is heating up. Are we at risk for Belarus now joining the war against Ukraine? Nobody wants that, but it could get worse rather than better. So before we do all that, we want to tell you about an investor quiz that you can take, because you've heard us report that the U.S. dollar is losing value daily, our national debt out of control, and you can bet no one in Washington or on Wall Street is worried about your finances and how you're going to retire. That's why only you need you. You have to become financially smarter and independent. It's the only way to break from the system. Now, if you're wondering how, there's a method that's proven time and again. Real estate has created more millionaires than any other investment type in history, and that's exactly how we broke free of our day jobs too, Clayton and I. We're able to do this because we aren't dependent on a boss, the stock market, or whatever nonsense is triggering Washington next, and you can do the same. Now your path will look a little different from ours. Figuring out your next steps can be tricky, so we built a 60-second quiz that shows you exactly where you'll stand as an investor and gives you simple, clear next steps for moving forward. So stop wishing you had a portfolio full of performing assets. Take action right now. Take this quiz and see where you need to go next. It's quick. Again, redacted.inc/quiz is where you can begin. redacted.inc/quiz.
Well, is California next? Troubling new data shows the ground underneath California moving in ways that we cannot afford to ignore. And a few weeks ago here on this show, we warned you about a major new earthquake study showing that two of California's most dangerous fault lines, the San Andreas and the San Jacinto, are now under the highest stress levels that scientists have seen in roughly 1,000 years. And of course, now look at just what happened last night in Venezuela. Horrifying. What happened, rocked by not one, but two massive earthquakes, horrifying images, families running for cover, buildings completely collapsing. And according to the U.S. Geological Survey, the first was a magnitude 7.2, and then just 39 seconds later, an even larger magnitude 7.5 struck in the same region. This is not normal shaking. This is a violent release of pressure. And of course, the devastation is just horrific. Thousands of buildings damaged, people running into the streets, rescue crews at this hour still searching through the rubble. I was just watching videos of the rescue workers trying to find and calling out for people's names and hearing their names buried underneath the rubble, hearing Anthony and just buried down under floors of rubble. Horrible. Entire neighborhoods suddenly turned into disaster zones. Early reports say at least 164 people were dead, nearly 1,000 injured. But at this hour, I mean, there are at least 10,000 people missing at this hour. So officials are warning that these numbers could rise dramatically. I think they don't want to scare people about how bad this could be, but hearing estimates well over 100,000 people. Rescue teams reached the hardest hit areas. The USGS issued its highest alert level for this event, warning that widespread damage, severe casualties were likely, but this did not stop, of course, with Venezuela. On the same day, California was also hit by seismic activity, including a reported magnitude 5.6 quake in Northern California. Now, to be very clear, scientists are not saying the Venezuela earthquake caused California to shake. Earthquakes are complicated, of course, and what happened in Japan, separate, of course. You cannot draw a straight line from one fault system to another and say this one triggered that one. But what tectonic experts are watching is the pattern major energy releases across active fault zones, back-to-back events, increasingly stressed systems that have been locked up for far too long, for a very long time. Dr. Kimberly Blisniak, excuse me, I want to make sure I get the name pronounced correctly, is an earthquake geologist at San Jose State University, and Dr. Kimberly joins us now. Before I move on, can you correct my pronunciation of your last name so I don't butcher that again?
It's Blisniak, Kimberly Blisniak.
Blisniak. Okay, I was close, close upon second. Just at first glance, doctor, can you give me your assessment of what stands out to you for the events over the past 24 hours, both in California, Venezuela, Japan, and other regions that you've been watching?
So, we, as earthquake geologists, we know earthquakes happen all the time, and we would like to just prepare the society and people that live near active faults to be ready for earthquakes. And earthquakes are unpredictable, as we know, and in the sense of Venezuela, we did not expect the seismic doublet to occur. But we know these earthquakes happen. And when they do happen, they can be quite devastating. And in California, as citizens of part of the community, we should really be prepared for a major disaster so that it doesn't turn into a catastrophe. And we know that an earthquake is going to happen in California. Possibly in our lifetime, we can't predict earthquakes, but we do know that we are ready for a big earthquake.
So wow. I myself am from Fremont, California. So I know that retrofitting is big business in California. Mm-hmm. When you look at what happened in Venezuela, is there any amount of retrofitting that could have prepared them for this if they in fact live on a fault line? Or is this just a matter of wealthy societies that cannot contain?
You know, we can retrofit buildings and build to withstand a certain amount of shaking. And it is true that in more developed countries like the United States and Japan, when large earthquakes do occur, the life that is lost during these disasters are less. But in any sense, they're still disasters. They still affect society. In areas like Japan, we know there are tsunamis. We can also get a tsunami in California. These are major earth disasters that Mother Nature, they happen, and we just need to be prepared. I don't know how else to...
Right. Yeah, and if I may follow up on that, you know, as Californians, we always say, oh, good, there's small earthquakes. It relieves pressure on the fault line. Is that just something we say because, you know, so the ones yesterday are not to be conceived of that way? They did not release pressure on the fault line?
You know, as humans, we're very resilient. That's how our minds work. You know, we can never imagine an earthquake can happen in our lifetime. And when they do happen, it becomes a disaster. And it's just, we need to just be prepared for an earthquake in California.
A big one in California.
A big one. And the last earthquake, the last major earthquake in California was the 1906 earthquake that hit San Francisco. And in 1989, we had the World Series that was stopped due to Loma Prieta. And so we've had major earthquakes in California that have been very destructive. And we lived through them. We forget about them. And when the next earthquake occurs, we will survive it, but it will be very disastrous. And so as to be prepared for these earthquakes, we need to just make sure we have a earthquake safety kit to make sure you have, you know, your power's gonna go out, you're not gonna have the internet, you may not have running water, all of these, life amenities will not be at our fingertips. And so we need to be prepared to have one or two days where we have enough water to wash our dishes, to cook, to clean ourselves. We want to make sure we have enough food in our pantry to, you know, eat. We want to have some candles, some extra batteries, all of these things so that when and if an earthquake does occur, our own personal lives may be a little easier so that the rest of society can get back to its normal.
So I just want to be clear about what we're seeing in California, because a few weeks ago here on the show, we talked about what researchers were warning there about both of these zones, the San Andreas, the San Jacinto fault lines. And that researchers have been saying that this is a critically loaded state, that they are, it's a critically loaded state. And the key area, the Cajon Pass near Southern California, where two fault systems come together, and their scientists, as we reported, had called it an earthquake gate because of the stress levels here. So I guess what we're saying is we saw this happen yesterday. We saw these small earthquakes in California. Just to confirm that we don't know that it relieved any kind of a pressure at all. Like, oh, good. We've got another 50 years. We don't have to worry about it. That's not how this works, does it?
No, that's not how it works. So the study that you're referring to is a compilation of what we call paleoseismic data. So paleoseismic data is the study of earthquakes that have occurred in the past based on what we see within the sedimentary record, within the rock or sand record. And what geologists can do is we can dig a trench across the fault. And by looking at the layers of sediment that has been displaced and dating those sediments, we can get an idea of how many earthquakes occurred on that particular section of the fault over time. And so using that data for over 1,000 years, this recent study showed that now that we know what the when earthquakes have occurred in the past, we can see how much stress has accumulated between these earthquakes and how much stress may have been released during those earthquakes. And so since we know it, along the southern San Andreas Fault, the last earthquake to occur was the 1857 earthquake. It was a big one. And because we haven't had a big earthquake since then, we've always, as Californians, know that we're getting ready for the big one. In this particular study, it's a very nice study where they were able to actually quantify the amount of stress that has accumulated along both the San Jacinto and the San Andreas Fault. And as a result, what they were able to show is that, yes, we do know the big one is coming. We don't know when, but we do see that when we model what we know about previous earthquakes in California with physics-based modeling of the crust, we see that the state of California between the San Jacinto and San Andreas Fault near the Cajon Pass is at a very high stress level. We can quantify that, and it's the highest in since the last earthquake, which is the 1857 earthquake.
Wow. Yeah,
and we covered that on the show a few weeks ago. We talked about 1857. You know, no one lived there. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was not like it is today. So this could be devastating. I guess, did you have another question?
No, I guess that's very paradigm shifting because, again, as Californians, you just say, oh, good, a little release of the pressure of the fault, and you go on with your life. And maybe that's something comforting that we shouldn't say to each other because we need to constantly be ready and prepped.
Yeah, I think as scientists who study earthquakes, we really just want society and the community to be ready for an earthquake. We can't prevent an earthquake, but we can be ready for something that may be very catastrophic. Mm-hmm. And so the best thing we can do for ourselves and for our community is to be ready. And I use the example of insurance often. We buy car insurance, we buy home insurance. Hopefully Californians have earthquake insurance, but we buy insurance not thinking that we want to get into a car accident. We buy insurance because if we were to get into a car accident, then we have something to help us move towards or move past that accident or that trauma.
Yeah.
And so when we think about an earthquake, we're not going to be able to prevent earthquakes, but what we can do is prevent the trauma that may occur because we weren't prepared for that earthquake. And so my suggestion would be to have people really think about, okay, this happened in Venezuela. We never think it's ever going to happen to us. The best thing we can do is just have an earthquake safety kit. Make sure we have some food in our pantry, in the garage, extra, you know, gallons and gallons of water, some flashlights and candles, just so that if we can't leave our home because there's, you know, everyone is asked to stay in place, that we'll be comfortable and we'll be with our loved ones in a less traumatic way.
Yes.
I guess before we get you out of here real quick, mm-hmm. with the few seconds we have left, Doctor, California has not handled disasters well recently. We saw, of course, everyone watched the wildfire disaster in California, a total disaster. Is California prepared for the big one?
I do not think so. I think we do have different mechanisms in place, such as the earthquake early warning system. There's certain aspects where the power that's going through power lines or public transit will stop this as soon as we know a big earthquake is going to happen. But we're doing as much as we can, but there's so much to do. Yeah. And so
how do you prepare for what we saw in Venezuela?
It's really hard to prepare for such a disaster, but the hope is that disaster does not become a catastrophe.
Right. The preparation to make sure that the mm-hmm. response, the rescue crews, like all of that follow-up pieces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For sure.
Well, Dr. Blisniak, thank you for giving it to us straight. That was a sobering mm-hmm. assessment, but we really appreciate your expertise.
Yeah. Thanks for not pulling any punches.
Yeah.
Thank you, Doctor. Great to see you.
Okay.
From San Jose State mm-hmm. University. We appreciate it. All right. Well, you know, I guess that's what, you know, Californians tell themselves, right?
Let's
let out some pressure. It's fine. That's not how this works.
That was very paradigm shifting. Yes, we do tell each other that, like, okay, a little one, that's good. Relieve some pressure on the fault line. I guess if it doesn't work like that, you have to constantly be vigilant. You know, something that I do, because I've been increasingly preparing our emergency stashes because of the war, is set a calendar reminder every 6 months to look through it to make sure your batteries are not dead, your food's not expired, you still have it. Because a lot of us, after the 1989 Loma Prieta, we put earthquake kits in the garage, and then I remember what it looked like a year later, just full of dust, right? Yeah. So you have to constantly be on it. It has to be something that is, you know, like balancing your checkbook, like go through it, like make it a routine of maintenance in your house.
All right. Well, our obviously thoughts with the people of Venezuela and how devastating that is. It's just horrific to see those images and the rescue crews going through, just yelling out people's names, or, you know, just trying to catalog who's still trapped under this rubble and trying to get them food and water in a way that they can without stepping on the rubble to further cause problems. It's just horrendous. So,
it's making my anxiety such that I don't want my kids to leave the house.
Yeah.
You know, everybody stay here at all times, so I have all eyes on you. It's just a really hard way to live.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk about the Fed and why everyday Americans right now are struggling, but how is the Fed managing to get richer? How exactly does that work? We're going to talk about their balance sheet, which they haven't shortened after the 2008 collapse. In fact, it's just grown tremendously. So we'll talk about that. But first,
we want to tell you about our friends at Angel Studio, because one of the things I love most is learning the stories behind the people who shaped history, because greatness isn't built upon only success. It's built on failure, perseverance, and character. That's why I was excited to learn about young Washington. This isn't the story of George Washington as president. It's the story of a young man who faced setbacks, near-death experiences, and impossible decisions long before he became the leader that helped found this country. It's directed by John Irwin and features an incredible cast, including Andy Serkis, Ben Kingsley, and Kelsey Grammer. So you know this is going to be big screen experience. And here's the best part. Right now, for America's 250th birthday, you can become a premium Angel Guild member for just $15 a month or $135 for the year. You'll get 2 free tickets to Young Washington in theaters this Independence Day, plus 2 free tickets to every feature that Angel Theater releases. You'll also get access to Angel's growing library of films like Homestead, Green and Gold, Something to Stand For with Mike Rowe, and The Last Rodeo. So take advantage of this limited time offer. Help support more films that celebrate the people and stories that shaped America. So find out more for yourself. It's angel.com/redacted. You'll join the Angel Guild today and support more independent-minded media. One more time, that's angel.com/redacted. All right, how are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Okay, take a little breather. Yeah, what, do you guys believe it? The big one's coming?
Well, a lot of people say that it's good to be prepared. Someone said, how dare you waste our time with preparing us for an earthquake in California? Sorry for that.
You don't think, I mean, look at home prices.
Marge, I'm glad Marge is strong. Marge says, shame on Redacted for wasting our time with the death of thousands of people in Venezuela. I'm sorry, Marge. Marge sent you.
Okay. Well, I had a point to refute that, but that's okay. If you don't like it, then I apologize. I don't like it either. I don't like seeing devastation and death.
No, and I want to know, like, the response. I want to know how California is going to be able to respond to this and the bureaucratic disaster that we saw, of course, during the fires.
Right. The economics of the fallout of that fire still affects us today. Look at housing prices. Look at building costs. It continues.
A massive land grab. Mm-hmm. The other piece of the story is, like, after this happens, like, what will be the government massive land grab?
Oh, yeah. You know. Can you be a part of it if you're an opportunist? If you don't like this, go ahead and invest in it.
Marge, you could take advantage of that.
Exactly right. Okay. Well, we're still waiting on our guests.
Oh, okay.
Shall we?
Oh, we are? Okay.
Yeah.
Let me see what we got here. Let's take some super chats then.
Okay.
Let's see here. Let's see what we got here. Stephen Burns about these earthquakes and how the sun has tremendous effects on the earth. He's an expert on this topic. Okay. Thanks.
Oh,
we'll check
thank
in with
you.
Stephen, geophysicist, Stephen Burns. You know, one of the things we've been talking about too is what's been happening, obviously, in Italy, in the Campi Flegrei, and what's been happening under Mount Vesuvius. And all of, like, those massive, massive steam pots basically underneath those areas. It's not just like Mount Vesuvius. And why are steam vents showing up in Rome, like, you know, hundreds of kilometers away?
Right.
Like, so all of this area underconnected underneath the Naples area has been, like, primed and ready to pop for a long time. So again, that's another big piece of this.
All right, let's talk about why the Fed is getting richer, shall we? While everyday Americans struggle with inflation and declining purchasing power of the U.S. dollar, the Federal Reserve has begun to enrich themselves. How does that work? Well, the Federal Reserve just released its balance sheet this week. The balance contains a surplus of, well, not a surplus, but it's up $11 billion in the week ending June 17th to $6.74 trillion. That's the highest since March of 2025. Total assets have gone up $162.8 billion since the start of the year. And again, I just wonder, how does that happen? How is it possible that the dollar continues to deflate? How is it possible that the United States continues to have such rising debt? How is it that President Trump has now asked Congress for more war funding? And at the same time, while the American dollar goes down, while purchasing power goes down, the Fed has enriched itself. I'm just curious. So we decided to ask Peter Schiff. He's an economist, the author of The Real Crash, How to Save Yourself and the Country. And he joins us to discuss, how is it that the Fed, this private cartel, seems to be doing well while the rest of us are kind of not?
Yeah, I was just trying to get everything set up. I didn't. Are you hearing me?
I hear you just fine. Yeah.
Okay, good, good. Is it framed up?
You look good.
We hear you loud and good. Yeah, you look great. You look great.
Yeah, all right, thanks.
So back to the question. The question is, how is it that everyday working Americans are hurting right now, but the Fed's doing fine and, in fact, starting to increase its balance sheet, going upwards instead of downwards like the rest of us?
Yeah, you know, everybody is attributing all these hawkish statements to Kevin Warsh. You know, he's going to start raising interest rates. He's going to be fighting inflation. Yet he's continuing to preside over a Fed that's creating inflation. The money supply continues to expand. The balance sheet continues to expand. And they didn't hike rates. I mean, people expect them to hike rates maybe at the next meeting or sometime a couple times before the end of the year. But why didn't he already do it? And in fact, a lot of the stories we're getting today are computer companies raising prices. Microsoft raising the price of the Xbox, or Apple raising the price of its iPhones and its iPads. You know, this consumer electronics was one of the few places that, you know, consumers got a little relief, because the productivity gains in that sector, in many cases, were able to offset the inflation that the government created. So despite inflation, those prices came down. And so it helped keep overall prices in check. But now, computer prices are rising too, electronic prices. So consumers have no relief. Everything is going up.
Well, once again, can I just reiterate this question? How can the Fed have more at a time like this?
Will the Fed have more what? You mean have more money? More money?
Yeah.
Well, that's what they do. They create inflation. That's what they're there to do. You know, Walsh said it during his press conference or in the past that inflation is a choice. And he's correct. That's what the Fed chooses to do. They've been choosing that for decades. And I think Warsh is going to make the same choice, because if you don't choose inflation, then what you end up choosing is something that is politically unacceptable, which is big stock market decline, real estate decline, bond decline, recession, financial crisis. And you force the government to act fiscally responsibly, which means big middle class entitlement cuts or middle class tax increases. And none of this is politically doable. So it's not going to happen. We're going to have a lot more inflation. And, you know, consumers had better be prepared for that.
President Trump, of course, is holding up this housing bill right now in order to try to push the Senate on this Save America Act. But of course, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen at all. As our friend Tucker Carlson pointed out, the Senate vociferously fought to defend the surveillance of Americans through the FISA carve out. But they, as it comes to voting, don't seem to care about the SAVE Act. Anyway, no lower prices right now for individuals who really can't afford houses. This, of course, is a major concern for young people in the United States average age of buying a house now, starting instead of being 31 years old, is now what, like close to 40 years old?
Yeah.
Listen to President Trump, and I get you to respond to this, Peter. Take a listen.
Maybe anywhere. It's all about the interest rate. Lower the interest rates, you can have all the housing you want. But you have to understand, I don't want to hurt people that own houses, too. These people, for the first time in their lives, they have valuable houses. They become rich. I don't want to hurt them either.
Sir,
what you want to do is what good for everyone? Get the interest rates down. We have this numbskull that was the head of the Fed before, and he's a stupid person. And we call him too late because he was too late with the interest rates all the time. We need low interest rates. Low interest rates will solve everything. We'll solve that. Now, despite that, we're doing well with housing. But where we're really doing well is oil is plummeting and costs are coming down.
So he wants them lower, not higher.
Yeah,
is that a new? Did he just say that again? Because I've heard him make that comment before. Is that a new clip?
This was today, a few hours ago.
Oh, so he's reiterating that same thing. Yeah, he wants housing prices to go up because he wants people that already own houses to be able to pretend that they're rich. He doesn't care about younger people who are struggling to buy the homes. He cares about the people who bought them 30 or 40 years ago. But home prices are too high. It is a bubble. Home prices have to come down. But instead of having more affordable housing because prices come down, Trump just wants the Fed to lower interest rates so that people can afford to borrow a bunch of money to overpay for a house. Well, he said lower interest rates will solve everything. Artificially low interest rates are the cause of all of our problems. That's where the inflation is coming from. The Fed is creating inflation to artificially suppress interest rates.
Right. And so as we see now, what do you think that President Trump is saying? The last guy wouldn't do what I want. Now I got a good guy. Do you think that means this guy's going to do what he wants?
I mean, he's still got 12 other board members. How's it going to happen?
And that's also ironic because now the markets are expecting rate hikes. When Powell was there, they were at least expecting unchanged. So if Trump didn't like Powell because he didn't cut rates, what is he going to think of Warsh when he starts hiking them? Because that's what everybody thinks he's about to do. I guess everybody but the president.
Right. And in the meantime, the president is not controlling government spending whatsoever. You put this on X today, so I'm going to show you your own words and let you explain it further. You're saying that Trump is asking Congress to approve an extra $87 billion in new spending for the war. But since he isn't also asking Congress to cut spending elsewhere or raise taxes to pay for it, he's asking the Fed to create more inflation so consumers will pick up the tab by paying higher prices. Can you say more about that? Because it's happening.
Well, exactly. I mean, look, Trump wants the government to spend more money, but he doesn't want the government to raise taxes. He's not willing to identify someplace where the government can cut spending to offset the extra spending he wants for the military. And so it's just going to be financed by inflation. We're going to have bigger deficits, and the Fed's going to have to print more money, or they're not going to have to, but they will, because the alternative is to let interest rates really rise. You know, Donald Trump says he wants low interest rates. Well, if he wants low interest rates, then reduce government spending so that the government borrows less money, because it's all that borrowing that's what's driving rates higher. And the reason that rates are going to go up and not down is because of the big deficits that Donald Trump is supporting as president. He signed on to the big, beautiful bill. In fact, he helped get it through Congress. So it's his fault that inflation is going up, and it's his fault that interest rates are going up.
Before we let you go, Peter, you know, obviously you see what's going on with the U.S. dollar right now. Seems to be surging. And it seemed like Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent really acknowledged the fact that we went to war with Iran was really for the U.S. dollar and U.S. dollar hegemony. He alluded to that. And then you're seeing what's happening with gold and silver right now. Well, today it's up. But where do you see gold and silver going given this push to protect the U.S. dollar?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't describe the dollar as soaring. And it's moved up a couple of percent. But you know, it's not a huge move. But yes, the dollar has gained some strength recently. And the reason for that is the expectation of higher interest rates and a tighter Fed, the opposite of what Donald Trump claims is coming. And that's also why gold and silver have come under pressure, because now, you know, the markets have gone from expecting easier money and rate cuts to tighter money and rate hikes. Now, I think the markets are wrong. I think the Fed is going to be a lot of talk, but not a lot of action when it comes to fighting inflation, because I don't think the U.S. economy could withstand a real inflation fight. Now, we need it. We have to have a severe recession. We have to have a big decline in overpriced assets, but nobody wants that. None of our politicians, and certainly not President Trump, and I don't even think the Fed wants that. The Fed doesn't want to see another financial crisis, the stock market crash, and so they are going to make the same decisions that they've been making for decades. They are going to monetize all this. They're going to cut rates. They're going to expand the balance sheet, and that's going to make the affordability crisis worse. And ultimately, that's going to derail the dollar. If the war was meant to preserve the dollar status, it's the deficit spending and the inflation that are going to destroy the dollar's reserve currency status.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I don't see how in the world $39 trillion in debt, $1 trillion just on interest payments alone for this boondoggle, how it's reversible at this point. I don't know. Can the Fed print their way out of this mess, Peter?
No, well, they printed their way into it. So you're not going to, you know, you can't drink your way out of being drunk.
Some would disagree with
hair
you.
Hair of the dog.
Yeah. The next morning after a bender, I guess some people would disagree
with you.
Well,
that's dealing with a hangover, maybe, the hair of the dog. But, you know, we can't sober. If we're still drunk, drinking more isn't going to sober us up.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. What a mess. What a damn mess. Peter Schiff, thank you as always. People should follow Peter on X because his wisdom and his insightfulness, you should set those alerts on X, because I always look to Peter for cut through the BS and the fog of the craziness of these markets right now, because there's a lot of weird emotions happening in these markets right now. Peter, great to see you as always. Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right. All right, coming up here on the show, we're going to talk about the Netherlands. And yeah, well, they admitted yesterday that they had euthanized a 12-year-old. That's right. That's the move, of course, in Canada, leading the way on these assisted suicides around the world. But the modeling for children is now unfolding in Canada, which is really going to be matching what's happening in the Netherlands. So euthanizing children as young as 0, 1 years old? How do they get to speak for themselves? Well, just the state, the government decides, time to put that one out of its misery.
We don't need that one. Let's not let it grow up.
Oh, like this is what's happening in the world right now. These sick, demonic governments. Okay, that's what's happening in the EU. We're going to check in on all of that in a moment. But first, you talk about disclosure, right? Yesterday, we were hoping maybe to see something big during that Brazilian-Scotland game, but that didn't happen. What if disclosure isn't really about waiting on an official announcement or some big event, like at a soccer game? What if it begins with your consciousness? Is it ready to recognize what's been here all along? Those who've been studying disclosure understand that actually it might be the level of consciousness that has allowed certain individuals to have these interactions. These whistleblowers and others who've been in the government, who've worked in the military, and who've been a part of this. Well, Gaia is the streaming service dedicated to the evolution of consciousness, with powerful series, films, and documentaries on disclosure, on ancient wisdom and the nature of reality. Because proof is one layer, perception is an entirely other layer. Gaia helps you dive deeper into the UFO disclosure through whistleblowers, insiders, consciousness, expanding voices who've been shaping this conversation for years. So you can dive deeper into disclosure consciousness and the possibility of contact. We'll have it linked up in our description because this URL is a little long, but I'll read it to you anyway in case you're driving and want to try to write it down. It's gaia.com/LP/disclosure-trial-redacted. So that's their URL to try it out right now, but we'll have it linked in the description so you can just click right on it. You don't have to worry about trying to write it all down. And check it out. Empathy prepares us. Compassion is part of readiness. Cooperation is how we move forward. So check it out and check out our friends at Gaia. I've been to their offices. They have beautiful, beautiful offices at Gaia. What's going on here? This is Eve. This is Eve. What are you doing in our studio?
Why is the dog growling and you coming in here?
What is going on? Are you getting in trouble? Man, summer break. When does school start again?
Mid-August.
Yeah, that's right. Hope it happens soon. Let me see if I can hope it happens soon.
I guess there's no emergency, but the dog is growling.
And guess, you know, you can wear pajamas all day. That's what happens.
She's not in pajamas. That was my sweatshirt.
Oh, okay. It just looks like it.
Yeah.
Five sizes too big. Actually, you're about the same size as her. She's a peanut, and you're a peanut as well. So
that hurt my feelings.
It's about one size too big.
I am mighty.
Mighty but small. All right. Well, here's a disturbing story out of the Netherlands, where we now learn that a 12-year-old was euthanized, yes, put to death, 2 years after the country removed the age limit. And we only learned about this 1 year after they put the child to death because they had to report it to their House of Representatives. The Dutch government legally euthanized severely ill children allows now between the ages of 1 and 12. They legalized this back in 2024. In other words, a 1-year-old or a 3-year-old can just be put to death by the government. Of course, Canada is ground zero for assisted suicides. Like, no one does a bigger job of exporting suicide than Canada. It leads the world in this demonic practice. Canada has, in a 2023 parliamentary report, began suggesting that mature minors, whatever that means, be allowed to be put to death. And then the College of Physicians in 2025 was reported saying we should extend it to babies, 0 to 1 year old, because they can speak for themselves. Zero? Which the Netherlands already do. So the Netherlands already allows this madness. Canada is on the same path as the Netherlands, of course, because they need to catch up. Kelsey Sheeran is the author of Do No Harm and the host of the Kelsey Sheeran Perspective, and she's perhaps the leading voice on trying to stop this demonic practice in the country of Canada. Kelsey, welcome to the show. Great to see you again.
Thank you guys for having me back. I appreciate it.
Our pleasure, and congrats on your newborn. It's hard to think of it. You know, you just had a baby, and it's hard. Can you imagine? I just can't wrap my head around the idea that the government would say, you know what, this baby can speak for itself. We think it's time to put this baby down. What do you think about this?
You know, I actually just had this conversation with my husband last night because I can't help but look at her and then see the fight that we're fighting right now and understand that there is so much more to this, and the people that are involved in pushing this are, they're not just demonic. These people don't have children themselves. These people aren't happy. These people are overweight. These people have no purpose. The only purpose they have is trying to end more lives of vulnerable individuals. And even just this week, some of the stories that I'm going to be breaking on some upcoming shows that I can't quite discuss yet are going to blow people's minds around coercion and individuals in our healthcare facilities forcing individuals towards a path. And people will say that's not happening, but we have several reports of this. And when we look at children, you said it, babies can't make this decision, but doctors can coerce, you know, individuals who are struggling with the idea of their child being unwell or their child going through temporary periods of suffering. But when I look at her, the idea that this is even happening and has happened now is really disturbing. Now, the Netherlands is the forefront leader of this, obviously not in the death count itself. Canada takes the cake with almost 8% of those, in Quebec being, you know, the tip of the spear, killing the most people in the world in one single province. That's looking at a state, right? So for those that don't know that I'm Canadian, we have provinces, America has states. And this isn't just a Canadian issue. In the new book I wrote that will be coming out in March, Do No Harm, we took a look, a heavy look at America and the 13 states and one jurisdiction expanding rapidly with Compassion and Choices, stating emphatically they want over 50% of the American population living in states that euthanize, and you already have so many doing it. So most people are unaware of that. Yes, it's for track one, but that's, I like to make people very clear, understanding that track one is how Canada manipulated its population into accepting the killing program. And that's now what's happening here. And it was the same with the Netherlands and every other nation. Now, the Netherlands story is really important to pay attention to, because the Netherlands, this child, we actually was under the age of 12. We don't actually know the age of this child. That would have been between 1 and 12 for sure. The reports that we have right now is that this was a terminally ill child. And this is where it gets a little sketchy, because the minister, Sophie Hermans herself of the Public Health Committee, wrote a letter to Parliament. And not only that, is the assessment committee has reviewed this case itself, and they have passed an assessment to the Public Prosecution Service. Now, that's important to note, because this doctor is going to be looked at, and they're going to decide whether, now this is post the child being killed and murdered, okay? So nothing can be done. But what can be looked at is whether this doctor actually followed what is considered the law. Now, the assessment will be done, but like I just stated, if they deem that this doctor did not follow through on what they should have, the child is already dead. So there is nothing that can be done. And why this is so important is because we have the same policy in Canada. You know, we have the May Death Review Committee that has spoken about recently on several different shows, and they are looking at post-mortem. So they are looking at whether people have been killed wrongfully. And what we do know now is that there were 400 non-compliant cases that the Ontario Coroner Report found alone in 1 year. Now, that's important to know.
400 non-compliant?
What does that mean?
Yeah, non-compliant means, well, exactly what you think. They didn't qualify. They were coerced. We had an individual that had this thing called... she had a thing called chemical sensitivity. Now, she was then not able to get housing, so she was mated. We had a lady who was obese. She was mated. We had some homeless people who were mated. Now, we need to actually stop using the term made, because made is a... what I discuss in my new book is a way that the death cult community has gotten individuals to believe that we should be accepting medical murder. This is medical murder. This is where you walk into an office where a doctor puts in two IVs, floods your body with so much poison, and you die. Now, we hope you die quickly, but we do have recent new cases that have come out, and I'm sure you guys have heard it in the media, where individuals have been halfway through the process and started screaming, "Help me." Oh. We have had Dr. James McLean in Ontario, who only got a slap on the wrist, who is still allowed to practice MAID, who actually did not bring all of the drugs to a procedure recently. And the patient was deemed deceased. He left. The patient woke up. The family members had to go tell the doctor. And then he had to come back in to finish the job. Now, he's a doctor in Westmont Family Clinic in London, Ontario. I say the name of it so people can stay away from it. He is only on a suspension. He can still provide MAID with somebody watching. Him and his wife both work there. And this is nothing new, my friends. Canada is looking at expanding. And the biggest thing in the media that has come out in the past couple of weeks is that Canada, there was a committee, the AMED committee came forward and they decided that they would like to recommend to the government that we do not expand to the mentally ill. Now, yes, that may seem like a win on paper, but the reality is the federal government can decide to just push that through anyway. And the reason why we should pay attention to that is because there is an ongoing court case in the province of Ontario right now with an individual being funded by the death cult Dying with Dignity, which you guys have heard me talk about before. They're terrible humans. They are funding this one woman, Claire Brousseau, who has a mental illness and depression. She's an actress from Montreal. And her greatest claim to fame right now is she is the defendant. She is fighting the government to be euthanized for depression. Now, if she wins that case, let's be clear, the AMED committee's suggestion or, hey, we shouldn't roll this out to the mentally ill, goes right out the window. This is how Carter versus Canada happened in the first place. Oh. It wasn't an AMED committee. It was a court case. And this is happening again. So yes, as it sits, a committee suggested to the Canadian government we should not be expanding to the mentally ill. But the government hasn't ruled on it yet. And everybody's cheering. And I'm going, hold on here. The government hasn't said what they're doing yet. And on top of it, the Claire Brousseau case is going forward. And they have stated if she doesn't get the win, they have another individual that they will bring the case forward. Because Dying with Dignity believes that we should be able to euthanize depressed people. And I disagree wholeheartedly. Now, children in itself have already been suggested in the 2023 report for the AMED committee calling for further expansion. Now, this was brought forward and very much ushered forward by Dying with Dignity. It's on their own website where it states, Dying with Dignity asks Parliament to amend the extending age requirement of 18 years old of age to extend it to persons at least 12 years old of age, and they are capable of making decisions with respect to their health. Now, just recently in the media today or yesterday, I believe, one of our provinces has removed parental rights down to the age of 12. So once you hit 12 years old, your family member cannot see your medical records and cannot make medical decisions for you. And we knew about this before because SickKids, the largest SickKids hospital in Canada, already does this. So your child will age out at 12 where you won't get to make medical decisions for them once they're past the age of 12. And they have suggested that children who would like to utilize, and like, again, still not legal, these are just words. Let me be very clear, because this is where people like to come at me. They are saying that, yes, of course, they will consult the parents. But the reality is the child's wants and needs will be taken above the parents' wants and needs. I said this on Trigonometry. I read the blurb verbatim where it says this on their website. So the fact of the matter is the Canadian government, even though they have, the committee has temporarily stopped mental illness from coming forward in March of 2027, the government hasn't ruled on it. And there is an active court case going with Dying with Dignity to try to overrule it to make sure that Made for Mental Illness goes forward. We already have the committee suggesting and talking about it publicly, moving down to children. Like I said, the Netherlands has already had this. This has been a known. You know, the judge had euthanized a child with autism recently. So we shouldn't be shocked that this is happening in the country of Canada. Canada is already in a rapid decline and a fall in every aspect possible, forgetting healthcare. And so the fact that we're seeing this in the Netherlands, they've been doing this. They're just now kind of starting to admit this publicly. And this, again, like I said, this was reported to the actual public prosecution service to be looked at as an assessment. Now, that's not saying the doctor did anything wrong. They're saying that they have brought this forward. Not only has individuals been concerned, but the minister herself of public health wrote a letter and has brought this forward to the public prosecution's service. Now, that should give just shudder, like just you should be terrified of what that means, because that means there are actual doctors that are willing to kill children. And whether people want to say, well, that child was terminally ill or not, that doesn't matter. That means that there's a human that was willing to walk into a room and put IVs in a child and flood their body with poison and hope that they die in a very quick manner. Because like I've said before, these drugs are not tested for killing. We do not know how much it actually takes. We do not fully understand what it looks like in the body, because we do not measure the pain center of the brain when this process is happening. We need to stop calling it a provision. It's not a provision or a procedure. It's a murder. And it is done by a person in a white coat that we are supposed to trust. Right. And that is what sanctuary trauma looks like.
Now, I want to point out, because we covered this in 2024 when the government released its intention to extend the deadline by 3 years. So in 2024, they put out a call for academics saying, should we expand this to the mentally ill? And Almost no academic would go on record saying this was a good thing. They couldn't find anyone to go on record saying we should do this to children. And what they said, instead of, okay, we won't do it, they said, we'll just wait and find some academics who will go along with this. That was clearly in the report. You can look it up yourself. I recommend that our audience does. It's dated February 1st, 2024. It's called The Government of Canada Introduces Legislation to Delay Medical Assistance in Dying Expansion by 3 years. And they literally said, no one will let us do it, so we're going to wait and keep trying. What kind of demonic organization says, we want to do this, and so we're just going to keep trying until we get our way? That is crazy, and it shows the intention to kill.
Well, it not only shows intent to kill in that time frame, and they just did that AMED committee actually just this March, and it carried on for quite a while. It's all available, by the way, publicly. You can go under Canadian.gov and go actually watch the committee and the psychopaths themselves. You know, you actually had Jocelyn Downer, who she's a law professor, and she is one of the biggest ones that actually ushered forward the Carter case to get Canadians killed by their doctors originally. And, you know, she goes, you know, people who are depressed, if we we don't kill them, then they're going to kill themselves, literally. And I'm not being like, I'm not being facetious. She actually said, well, if people are mentally ill, they should have the right to end their life with a doctor. And if we don't do it, then they will do it themselves. So we should be able to kill them. And she argued this with a straight face on her face, which blew my mind. And then when we look at people, like, for example, the great point that you pointed out, no psychiatrist or psychologist would sit down and suggest this, because what they were actually being asked to debate was suffering, the definition of suffering, and irremediable or grievous.
Yeah.
And that's important to note, because they were arguing that people with mental illness cannot heal and they cannot get better if they are what is called treatment resistant. Now, I am a treatment resistant diagnosed with PTSD, major depressive disorder, and treatment resistant depression. Yet I am here doing the work that I am doing. And I am a qualifying patient right now under what they wanted to expand. And so are a significant amount of Canadians. It's important to note at the AMED committee this year, actually, they interviewed people from the Dutch. They interviewed the Dutch and the Netherlands that were psychologists, psychiatrists. We didn't have somebody who specialized in PTSD. We actually had the leading doctor, Dr. Greg Passy, who happens to be my psychiatrist, who has treated veterans for over 45 years, never lost a single one to suicide, and was the very first research post-Rwanda and Bosnia on post-traumatic stress disorder. He was not asked to testify. No other psychiatrist or psychologist in Health Canada testified. They took people from the Netherlands and outside of the country and had them testify. And they believed on some level, some of them did, not all of them, but they believed on some level that suffering and these conditions were not curable. And that's insanity to say to somebody who is struggling with a mental illness that you will never get better. And that is just a falsehood that Dying with Dignity has propagated in order for individuals to say that they should have the right to die by suicide, and not only die by suicide, to be murdered by their doctor. And that's what this Claire Brousseau case is that I'm speaking of, that is in Ontario. Dying with Dignity is brought it forward, it's funding it, and is using this poor woman's mental health incapacitation to actually bring this forward and use her to try to get the rest of Canadians who have depression killed. And that's what that will allow. The law will change if she wins.
Horrible. And we should point out, you're a veteran, served in Afghanistan. So what you went through in Afghanistan as an artillery gunner, talk about PTSD and depression. And of course, when you came back dealing with veterans who were depressed, suicidal, mm-hmm. turning that ship around, the Canadian government would just love to say that, don't work. Don't do any work to try to right this ship. Just
die.
Just die.
And I guess the question that must keep you up at night to that point is, how long until it's not my choice anymore?
Well, so here is the uncomfortable point. Now, I'm going to state that the study I'm about to bring up is a what if just a scenario was done by a university, Western University. It was not a law. It was not what's happening. They were saying this could happen, or this is a what if situation that I spoke about on Jillian Michaels. This study took a look at the amount of individuals that would be needed to save money for the government and what they would look like from 2027 to 2047. This study included non-voluntary and voluntary. So that was a really interesting thing to see, because they were looking at saving up to the tune of $1.273 trillion by providing MAID as a healthcare alternative. And that's what we're currently seeing. So when these people from the death cult write their pieces about me and do their hit pieces on CTV and CBC about me, they say that I'm nothing more than misinformation, when all I'm doing is reading their own reports in their own language. And they are stating, even if it is a what if situation, that this would never happen. Well, they sold us the same story in 2016 when they said this would only ever be for terminally ill patients. And now it's expanded rapidly and has continued to expand. And now we have euthanized over 100,000 Canadians in 10 years. And the pace at which we're going right now, we will end up killing 110,000 by the end of this calendar year alone.
God.
Isn't it one in eight deaths is a MAID death? One in five now. One in five deaths in Canada is a MAID death. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Can you imagine? It's
well, not all an effort to save money, right? I mean, I've asked you before. You know, that way they don't have to. They don't have to provide any sort of hospice care. They don't have to provide 20 years of care while they're in a senior home or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Like just kill them before they get to that stage.
Yeah. Yes. And they are very quick to state that, you know, we would never push this on people when we know they have. We have clear cases of this. They have said, well, we don't do it for the organs, but yet Canada all of a sudden is the highest in the world for organ donation. Now, it's not mandatory to provide your organs, but I did just speak with somebody on the phone a couple days ago where they were not told it was mandatory, but it was highly suggested. Now, this person has been euthanized and is no longer with us, and we're dealing with the family. And again, I will break that story soon. There is a lot going on with that that is very concerning, and I will call you the second I'm allowed to, because it's insane. But what's more insane is the fact of the matter is we have actual people lobbying the government in the Liberal government, which is now the majority in Canada because they bought off the votes from MPs, right? And we now have people who are pushing, promoting, and suggesting that this should be not only a healthcare alternative, this should be the way that we may move forward with people who are depressed and with the idea even discussing mature minors. Because let's be clear what mature minors means. Mature minors is not actually an age. Mature minors is what the doctor deems an individual is mature enough to understand the ramifications of their decision. Okay. Now that in itself should scare you because the verbiage there is terrifying. And this is not about legalizing euthanasia. All Canada did was will make it so that a doctor cannot be charged for euthanizing you because all the doctor has to say are these words. I was of the opinion the individual qualified and that they were irremediable or grievous. That's it. That's how they get away with murder. That's how you get 102 doctors out of the 2,200 plus that are euthanizing Canadians. That's how you get them doing over 50% of the deaths. That is a total billable hours of procedure and actual drugs of over $160,000 with only 52 deaths per person. So somebody could make their whole medical practice euthanizing individuals. They could get away with it because in Canada, it is a self-reporting system, meaning if you mess up, it's a self-reporting system. And we even have Health Canada calling on these doctors where you do not put the cause of death as maid. You put the cause of death as something else, and then maid is the secondary. So we don't actually know accurate numbers. And for the deaf community to say we do, that's just a bold-faced lie, and we can prove it right on paper.
Kelsey Sheeran has been our guest. We know you got to run. You got a baseball game to get to. Thank you for
football. Come on, don't put me in baseball.
What was it? What is
football? Like soccer?
My husband plays professional football, and it's game day, and I coach some of the athletes. Oh, okay. So we got to run and go do it.
Okay, I wasn't sure what sport. I just know there was a ball involved, and that was in your text messages. So I just want. All right, well, Kelsey, great to see you, and as you have more information about this as we go forward, we'd love to have you back as always. Thanks, Kelsey.
Thank you guys so much for covering this. I'll talk to y'all soon.
You bet. Thanks so much.
So just when you think you understand that, right. I thought that they were waiting on government advisory committees. They're not. They're trying to litigate their way into full force murder.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I just feel like this is like one of those things, like if you get a group of people together, like, okay, what's the dumbest thing we can think of? And this is the story you come up with.
Yeah.
Like everything she says, I'm just like, how do you get there? Like,
yeah, this you is just allow, and it, well, it's other, money, right? I mean, at the heart of it, it's money, but she's brought up the great point about not only the money piece of this, right? You know, $160,000. So someone could literally build their whole practice, their whole medical practice around killing people because you're making so much money from the government from it.
Right.
And you don't have to do anything else. You don't have to pull wisdom teeth. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to see a kid about stitches. Like, no, this is like, I'm a death doctor now.
You don't have to heal anybody. You just do the opposite. Them.
And then the opposite, and on top of that, it's the organ harvesting piece of this,
and
which
the
is
fail
also
rate.
And the amount of money that you can make from the organ harvesting.
Right.
Well, I'd be curious to see like if they specifically chose like the poisons they use, you know, the quote unquote medications, if they're specific to not destroy organs.
Oh, interesting. Like,
I don't know. I think I asked Kelsey that question the last time we had her on here in our deep dive interview a few months ago. I don't know that I got an answer to that, or I forget the answer to it. But yeah, like, are you going to want to have the organ from someone who's just been flooded with some poisonous toxic chemicals that killed the person?
Yeah, good point. Hadn't thought of that.
I guess, you know, if you're waiting on a kidney and...
You know, I talked to a friend recently who spent his life as an anesthesiologist, and he speaks out against the death penalty because of the high fail rate. And I said, do you know what's happening in Canada? And he said, no, not at all. He's a Stanford doctor who has no idea. But his whole platform is that you cannot kill someone reliably. The death penalty often doesn't work. It's a high fail rate. But he doesn't know. I don't think that these lobbyist groups overlap, because they don't know how often they're using this same technology. You know, what they call for a good cause has such a high fail rate. And it's terrifying to think, wait, I'm supposed to be dying. Why am I in agony? What's happening? I'm going to now live in more pain.
Horrible.
Yeah, it's a nightmare.
Well, thanks to Kelsey she's on top of it like nobody else. So awesome. All right. Coming up here on the show,
we're going to talk to Gilbert Doctorow about how there's increased attacks on Crimea. Now, Ukraine continues to attack Crimea. What does that mean? Does that mean that the war is only going to escalate? And how long until President Putin in Russia says, we're done with this? He seems sort of loath to put a decisive end to the conflict. Why? We're going to talk about that in a second. But first, Clayton's going to tell you about gold and silver.
Yeah, take a look. I don't know if you can see this, Philip. My Steam Deck's not working here, Steam Deck. But take a look at this. This is gold prices today. We saw a little bit of a pullback. We just had Peter Schiff on talking about gold and silver. And yeah, we saw a little bit of a rally in the U.S. dollar, just up a few points because of Scott Bessent's comments about, like, the reason we went to war in Iran is because of basically U.S. dollar supremacy. But Peter Schiff's point is you can only duct tape something together so long before water starts spilling out the sides of it. So yes, you saw a little pullback in gold over the past few days, maybe a great re-entry point. Silver pulling back a little bit from its all-time highs just a short time ago. So could this be an opportunity maybe to reassess where your savings are and maybe think about re-entering precious metals as we see some of this pullback here? And that's exactly what I'm going to do. We were talking to our team today about that. I said, hey, you know, as we see this like pullback, let's double down, because you're hearing from Brian Solarchuk, mining expert Brian Solarchuk, who's a legend in the mining business, K92 Mining. He said he sees gold hitting $10,000 an ounce. You see buy ratings or price targets for gold upwards of $6,000, $7,000 an ounce from different high profile banks. So, I mean, it's a question really of whether or not you believe in the U.S. dollar, or do you believe in something that's lasted 5,000 years and has protected people for 5,000 years, despite every government currency in world history collapsing. So, you know, if you're a betting person, what would you go with? U.S. dollar as a fiat currency or precious metals? I believe in having a small portion of your portfolio or a large portion of your personal savings in something that can protect your family. That's how I look at it, but you do you. But our friends at Lear Capital can help you. Just have a phone call with them. They're an American company. So if you get on the phone with them, just talk to them. Say, hey, I've got a few thousand dollars in U.S. savings in dollars. I'm thinking about converting this over to precious metals. What do you guys do? How do you guys work? Can you talk me through the process? And they will talk to you. They want to talk to you on the phone. They're an American company. They're not going to be farmed out to some call center in the Philippines. So if you call them, 1-800-613-3557, you can get your free gold guide from them. They'll send it right to your door so you can make a decision over the next few weeks what you want to do with some of that savings that you've been sitting on. Or maybe you have an old IRA or a 401k. Well, they were rated one of the top gold IRA companies from Consumer Affairs, because they can actually convert your old IRA or your old 401k into a precious metals IRA. So you can actually invest in precious metals. You could buy stocks in there. You could buy real estate, but you control it. It's a self-directed account. So give them a call today, 1-800-613-3557, or just go to the website LearRedacted.com. Once again, LearRedacted.com.
Well, Ukraine has this week stepped up its attacks on Crimea, presumably to bring the war to a crescendo. The war with Russia is not in Crimea, has not been since the special military operation. If you look at where Russian state media says the war is, Ukraine troops are hardly on the front lines at all. Russia is advancing towards its end goal steadily. Now, if you watch the American news, you'd be forgiven for not knowing that the war with Russia did not begin in 2022. It had been going on all along since 2014. The attacks on the Donbas region had been steadily increasing, and there were rumors that Zelensky had ordered it attack on Crimea just before that special military operation. The attack, again, was thwarted when Russia moved into the contested region to the north. So given Ukraine's inability to move Russia back along the front lines, why would they revert to plan A? What is the point of moving into Crimea? Gilbert Doctorow is a foreign policy expert on U.S.-Russian relations. He joins us to discuss. Thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
So can you make sense of this attack on Crimea? Why would they do it? And furthermore, how would they get there, given that they don't have direct access, given the new Russian border?
Well, they didn't get there. The attacks are by drones and missiles. The Crimea is quite close to the heartland of Ukraine. And so the distances are quite small. If you look at a map and draw a straight line between Odessa in the south of Ukraine and the Crimean Peninsula, you understand that the distances are very small. And within the scope of the production of drones by Ukraine itself, this is all within their own capability, not to mention the supplemental, very high-powered and more sophisticated drones that they surely are receiving from the United Kingdom, from France, Germany, Denmark, and other European countries.
And so we're seeing now images that I'm not sure how to verify of Russians leaving Crimea in order to escape that region. So how can we tell the scale and the scope of the attacks right now? And can you surmise why they would do this?
Well, they're spoiling the party. This is summertime. Several hundred thousand, if not more than a million, Russians have made vacation plans for themselves, for their children, in Crimea, because it always was a prestigious and very desirable place to spend summer vacations. And the Ukrainians are doing their best to spoil the fun. They have attacked the refineries and oil depots in Crimea, near Crimea, meaning that there's been a severe shortage of fuel, and that it's fuel rationing with the supplies being given to public authorities, and with the private car owners finding themselves short of fuel. That makes a vacation in Crimea quite difficult to sustain for Russians who are coming down by car, of which there are a great many. The attacks on Crimea are intended to catch the attention of Moscow, to force Mr. Putin into negotiations to end the war on terms that are, shall we say, favorable to Ukraine.
How would that give them an advantage? Just because Russians would have pressure on Putin to make this stop?
Well, the whole logic of the special military operation has been to secure the Russian-speaking population of what was pre-2014 Ukraine, going back to 1992. His borders then. By attacking the landmass that is within easiest reach of Ukraine, namely the Crimea, they are putting at risk everything that Mr. Putin has achieved in the last 4 years, 4.5 years of war. And they are getting the attention of the middle classes of Moscow, Petersburg, other towns, that the war is genuinely going on, that the Ukrainians have not rolled over and died, that the reported desertions of the Ukrainian army have little bearing on the security of land that is considered to be proper Russian Federation, as Crimea has been since 2014.
Right. I grow tired of seeing the Ukraine is trying to take back Russian-seized Crimea. That is a lie. There was no seizing of Crimea in 2014. In fact, Russia only used the troops that were already stationed there to push back the extremists that were moving into Crimea. and Crimea voted overwhelmingly to join Russia. So this idea that will again be spread through the press, it annoys me that, you know, Ukraine is taking it back. Can you respond to that?
Well, they're not going to take it back. That's clear. The question, though, is when will Russia respond adequately, appropriately, to the severe attacks it is receiving from Ukraine, both in the Crimea, most notably, on the battlefield in particular, and we can speak about that in a moment, the battlefield in Donbass, I mean, and in the heartland of Russia, where the Ukrainians have been causing severe damage, particularly to the energy infrastructure, the refineries, the storage of fuel in European Russia, a great distance from Ukraine's borders, proving that without having long-range missiles, they can do very nicely, thank you, with drones to achieve, to punish Russia severely for its ongoing war in against Ukraine.
So there begins the crux of our conversation, is how will Russia respond and finally stop this? Because they're experiencing terrorist attacks in areas that are not part of the war. And, you know, for us Westerners, we can't really understand the Russian response to that. Recently, we talked to Scott Ritter, and he said the people in the countryside are not that bothered by this, but the people in the cities are and want it to stop. Do you agree with that assessment?
Not at all. Scott Ritter and I are on opposite sides of many issues relating to Russia. He has visited, spent time in Petersburg and Moscow, and so on. So have I. But we speak to different people. I am not sponsored by a circle of Vladimir Putin. I'm not sponsored by Mr. Malafeyev and certain oligarchs that are supportive of President Putin. I'm not sponsored by anyone, in fact. But I do have a voice, and my voice is heard. And the fact that it is heard and repeated within Russia by rather authoritative media outlets indicates to me and proves to me that the debate on how to resolve the war is real and profound at the highest levels of Russian society and the Russian government. As for the countryside, let me just take issue with it, what you mentioned. I know it's a very big country. It's 145 million people, the largest country on Earth. And to pretend that any of us, whether the name is Scott Ritter or Gilbert Doctorow or any particular individual, has got his arms around the whole Russian society and can say what's going on is rather presumptuous. But he has his impressions and I have mine. And I also listen to people who tell me that particularly in the depressed areas of the Russian countryside, as in the Urals, you have villages of widows. The depressed areas are the areas where, first and foremost, the people in their 40s and 50s volunteered to enter the special military operation because they received up to 35,000 euros in sign-up fees, plus very generous monthly wages, one could say, for fighting in the territory of the special military operation. This is more money than these people have ever seen. And so many men in the depressed areas volunteered. And many men from the depressed areas have died, leaving behind widows. Now, that is a reality. I was in Petersburg, and I was sitting in the bank speaking to a manager. Oh, yes, and 2 days in a row, in came a double amputee. You see them on the streets, people hobbling around, to pretend that there is no visibility of the damage that this war is causing to Russian soldiers who sustain serious injuries, not to mention death, is to be blind. I'm not blind. And my friends and the people I met of all kinds of walks of life in business. In this particular visit, I'm spending time one of the leading notaries in Petersburg, with one of the leading real estate brokers formerly a company that you would know very well, the U.S.-based Century 21. People who have their hands on the pulse of the middle classes in particular. And they were telling me that there's war weariness, and people of whom they're in contact with want an end to this war. And they're not defeatists. They don't want to lose the war. But they believe that President Putin has in his power, as I believe, the possibility of ending the war by decapitation strikes on Kiev.
Yes.
The war.
Yeah. Which he has, you know, been, I don't want to say loath to do, but President Putin has not made those decisive strikes. And it's perplexing to those of us who don't know his mindset why he would allow this to continue, because I would imagine if we saw our major cities in the United States attacked steadily, we would get pretty anxious, to put it lightly.
Well, Russians are very patient, and I'm not suggesting that anyone's going to go out in the street and demonstrate over this, but people talk.
Yes.
And they understand very well. I mean, all kinds of people. I spoke about high authorities a moment ago, notary, top notary in the city and so forth. But I also spoke to movers, and the movers are not are working class people. And they're pretty shrewd. What I was listening to, they understand what's going on. And the question that they ask directly is, why is he dragging it out? So the question doesn't have an answer. We're all somewhat stumped by it. And I don't want to pretend that I have a better vision of what's in Vladimir Putin's mind. I don't have a microphone under his pillow, but I do see indecisiveness. I do see inadequacy in the Russian responses to, well, to these terror, you spoke about terror attacks. Indeed, apart from the very legitimate military attacks on military and economic infrastructure, which the Ukrainians are doing, they're also doing what you just described, terror attacks. They're killing, knowingly killing innocents for the sake of influencing public opinion. And that is not only in Russia, but also in Belarus. You know, you may be aware that there's been the possibility of a Belarus-Ukraine war. And while the public opinion polls in Belarus were genuinely favorable to Ukraine as a people, the murderous attack on a bus carrying school children from Belarus to a summer vacation in the south of Russia, probably in Crimea, that alarmed the Belarus public and enraged them against Zelensky and co. This killed the teacher who was chaperoning the students, and it left a number of students severely injured. And this was an intentional terror attack to give a message to Belarus to watch out because we're coming after you. So we are possibly on the cusp of a change in the war with Belarus being dragged into it by Zelensky. But that remains to be explored. But as regards Russia proper, the murderous attack on the dormitory of a teacher's college in the Donetsk region, this is about a month ago, mm-hmm. absolutely enraged the whole of Russian society. And what was the response from President Putin? A lot of blah, blah, to be honest about it. He's been doing a lot of speechifying. But real action, military action, was close to nil. They destroyed, they had a big, massive attack on Kiev. That's what the news was telling us. But when you looked at the details, they were attacking a factory producing gunpowder, a factory producing parts for drones. Hey, wait a minute. They knew about the location of these factories 5 years ago. Why were they only attacking them with drones and missiles now? The response has been inadequate, inappropriate to the scale of threat, just as on June 1st, 2025, the attack on the strategic airfields and bombers that are part of the Russian nuclear triad elicited no proper response from President Putin and his colleagues. According to the terms of the launch of the special military operation in February 2022, there should have been an attack and possibly a nuclear attack on Ukraine in response. Was there one? Zero. So we are all stumped by the lack of daring or the lack of follow-through of President Putin and his government against the real threats to Russian national security.
So, I mean, you could see it as a failing to protect his own people because these attacks will continue with such a tepid response. If you look at the map that I brought, now I get this from Russian state media, RIA, it shows the clustering. The blue dots there are the Ukrainian troops. The red dots are Russian troops. Is it possible, because of how close they are to completing what they say is their stated target, that President Putin is saying, you know what, let's just finish it. We're almost done. We're almost to that region where we've said we will stop. We're just going to finish it and be done. I'm just spitballing here. What do you think of that?
Well, you're touching upon a very important question. Many of my colleagues in alternative media are believing that when Russia reaches the Dnieper River, then the Ukrainians will throw up their arms, will capitulate, the Ukrainian army will collapse, and Mr. Putin will get everything he wants. I don't agree at all. The loss of the Donbas, which was one of the targets, targets of the special military operation, is not the same thing as turning Ukraine into a neutral country without foreign military presence. It isn't the same thing as a Ukrainian capitulation and peace. Nothing of the sort. Under present conditions, if Mr. Putin succeeds in taking the whole of Donbas at the end of the summer, as some people are predicting, without saying which year the summer will take be in, let's assume it is this year. So what? That isn't the end of the war. The Ukraine is receiving $95 billion in loans. 47 of that has already, I think, crossed the border from the European Union. These are non-repayable loans, in fact. And with that, you can buy a lot. You can pay good recruitment fees to Ukrainian volunteers. You can begin to pay off the widows. You can buy a lot of drones from England and other countries. There's no reason for Mr. Zelensky to capitulate. Mm. They'll keep on fighting. And with the new weapons that they are now developing, or which are being developed for them by the British, by the Germans, by the French, they will continue to attack, and they will reach with missiles Moscow a year from now. Now, if Mr. Putin thinks that this is the end of the war the way he wanted it in February 2022, it isn't. It will be an ongoing degradation of Russia's defensive capabilities and of its economy. During this period between the newly initiated rearmament program of Western Europe and their plans to launch an attack on Russia in 2029 or 2030, Ukraine is filling the same role of proxy for Western Europe as it did previously for the United States when President Biden was waging his war on Russia via Ukraine. Ukrainian fighters are taking the place of the boys from Germany and France who don't want to go. Germany, France, Britain, none of them have soldiers who are ready to fight against Russia. So Ukraine is useful to Europe, and Ukraine will remain supported by Europe even after Mr. Putin takes the Donbas.
Right. And so that leaves the question of, you know, we have thought Zelensky would have been out of there a long time ago because he's lost a lot of his media gravitas. He's annoying. All these reasons. He's corrupt. But he's like the Energizer Buddy. He just keeps going. So I think that your explanation of that he's so useful to Europe, European leaders, might be the answer to why he's still hanging on in there. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. And they have control over it. The recent threats he made about 10 days ago, he threatened Belarus that if they don't remove the electronic gear they have at their border, which helps guide Russian drones into the west of Ukraine, that if Belarus doesn't remove them or deactivate them, then he, Zelensky, will deactivate them, will destroy them, and will attack Minsk and other Belarus cities. And he was put up to that by the G7 European members mm-hmm. when he was in this meeting, when he was invited into the G7. This is a Russian news which has been picked up and presented to the readership, for example, of La Libre Belgique, the main one of the main French-speaking newspapers here in Brussels, yesterday, in their two-page article on the possible war that will break out between Minsk and Kiev. So they feel they have him under control, and they told him, your security, Mr. Zelensky, depends on your doing what we are asking of you, your personal security.
Right. So where do we go from now? So we're on the verge of a possible escalation, including Belarus, in this conflict. Ukraine certainly doesn't have the power to push back the contested region, but they do have the power to continue to keep this going by nicks and cuts. And so, you know, people in the West will continue to support it, including the United States, because for all the bluster of the Trump administration, they have not cut out the spigot of funding. People in Europe will continue to support this. And we see European leaders continuing to raise money and devalue the euro. And so what do you think? Do you think there will be a time when Russia has to respond decisively and shut it down, or this will continue again by nicks and cuts?
Well, Russia has a window of opportunity right now. Mr. Putin opened the special military operation in February 2022 because he and his colleagues were aware of a window of opportunity then. Namely, they had these Wunderwaffen, these wonderful state-of-the-art strategic weapons, which he had shown first in 2018, but which were in serial production by 2022. And which were years ahead of anything that the West had. I'm speaking now of hypersonic missiles and other strategic weapon systems. And so that was a window of opportunity, and now is a window of opportunity. When the Europeans have publicly said that they are ready for a war with Russia in 2029, well, why not do it now when they're not ready for the war? If I'm suggesting that Russia should devastate Ukraine, knock out the whole political class by attacking Kiev, Lviv, and other major cities where these political elites are sitting. And then there is no proxy for Europe to wage war on Russia. And they all will have to go back to the stone under which they were sitting before this opportunity to harm Russia came to them as a gift.
So you have a new series of war diaries, and your works serve as a really great anthology of the Western response to Russian conflicts, which have been escalating for decades now. Tell me about this project before I let you go.
Well, I've just published, in May, June of this year, I just published volume two on 2024. And volume three on 2025. And these are unusual. The books are unusual in the sense that they are a primary source. They are, I call them diaries in an expanded sense. They are daily journals, or almost daily journals, and they are also transcripts and links to my conversations with major podcast owners like yourselves, which give you a sense of what were the issues of the moment in media, what was on people's minds in the West, how this war was going, and on Russian minds, on how this war was going, and what did they expect to happen next. And of course, we've all been caught out because the war has evolved in unforeseeable ways. It's now, we can now call it safely a drone war, when that was no way foreseeable in 2022 or 2023. And I have organize the material around the changing nature of the war and the changing global context. The 2025 volume in particular stands out as being the year of Donald Trump, in which the action on the battlefield was shadowed, put in the shadows by the action of the diplomatic field, where Donald Trump was dominant and where everybody was responding to what he was doing, either leaning towards Vladimir Putin one day, and particularly including with him the summit in Anchorage, or seemingly leaning the other way in support of the Ukrainians. So these how the war moved as seen looking forward, as history looking forward, not history looking back. When you look back at history, then the lines of how things happened are perfectly clear to most anybody who isn't often nearsighted. And it looks like it was moving in an unchangeable way, that this was had to happen the way it did. When you're looking at history in the future, how things are going to be based on what you know today, nothing is certain. And our doubts and our uncertainties are what come out in this book, in these books. As I say, each book speaks of a specific period which had a part of this evolving war that was changed in the next part. And I'm hoping that what I'm now putting together, which is volume 4, and he's already got 150 pages of manuscript, that this will be the final volume. I'm very hopeful that either Mr. Putin or whoever succeeds Mr. Putin will do what has to be done and end this damned war, which has cost maybe 2 million casualties on both sides, the majority, of course, on the Ukrainian side. But that doesn't make the losses in Russia any less. If 350,000 or 380,000 Russians have died, and probably four times that number have been have their lives changed forever by severe injuries incurred during the war, that is a terrible price to pay. And Mr. Putin, who has said repeatedly that he tries to minimize the loss of life among his soldiers, the best way to do it is to end the war by blasting Kiev to hell right now.
Right. Which is not something we are advocating for, but decapitating the Ukrainian military would have saved a lot of pain, you know, some years back, and that has not happened. So I appreciate your perspective very much. My guest today has been Gilbert Doctorow. If you are not subscribed to his Substack, you are missing out on the ability to truly understand this conflict. It's one of my favorite Substacks. It's called the Armageddon Newsletter. Thank you so much for offering your time. It was a pleasure to catch up with you. I know you've been really busy traveling in and out of Russia, and that's why you're one of my favorite perspectives. So it's a pleasure to see you again.
Very kind of you to host me.
Well, before we go, we want to tell you about our friends at IQ Bar, because IQ Bar is our exclusive snack, hydration, and coffee sponsor. They have protein bars, IQ Mix hydration mixes, and IQ Joe mushroom coffees that are the delicious low-sugar brain and body fuel that you need to win your day. If you are curious about which types of IQ Bar products you might enjoy, you can order the Ultimate Sampler Pack. It's a great way to try all IQ Bar products and flavors. You get 9 IQ bars, 8 IQ mix sticks, and 4 IQ Joe sticks. Now, all of these products are clean label certified and entirely free from gluten, dairy, soy, GMOs, and artificial ingredients. I do keep the IQ mix hydration mixes with me in my purse. In my car, my favorite is the blood orange. You know, it's a great way if you need some electrolytes from whatever you're doing in your day. You can just quickly mix it in your water bottle. I carry them for my children. Also, the plant protein bars are a smarter snack choice with plenty of plant protein. So check them out for yourself. You'll be so glad that you did. Again, IQ Bar has become a part of our daily routine here, so check it out for yourself. Right now, they're offering our special podcast listeners 20% off all IQ Bar products, including the Ultimate Sampler Pack I just told you about, plus free shipping. So to get your 20% off, text REDACTED to 64000. One more time, that's REDACTED 64000. You'll be so glad that you did. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details. Well, that's going to do it for us today on Redacted. We'll have special content for you all throughout the weekend, but this is our last live show of the week, and we will see you next week as well. Please make sure that you're subscribed to Redacted if you're getting notifications. I know the algorithm is not your friend. A lot of our viewers are saying they have to work harder and harder to find us every single week. That seems to me personal. It does feel personal and purposeful, but you're here. So thank you for being here. Make sure that you join us next time. Thank you so much. We'll see you next time.